Okay, I'm going to formally introduce myself. I'm Pete Verdone. We've never talked in person ever before.
I don't think we've even emailed or, well, maybe that's about the seminar or something, but I don't think we've ever communicated about bicycles.
I don't think we have. So, tell us your name and who you are.
Steve Blinky, Blinky Cycle Works, Philadelphia, PA, builder.
So you're representing the hometown crew right here.
Yeah, well, it's real easy for us.
It's definitely an easy show, and I hear you know the organizer.
True. I helped organize the organizer.
Nice. So I've been around bicycling a long, long time, and I was up in Boston during the Fast Chance era, and we get kind of tribal when we talk about who you learn from, when and where, and all that kind of stuff amongst old people. And once you get south a little bit, it starts becoming all Blinky. Everybody's somehow interacted with Blinky. And what's up with that? You've been at this a long time. Tell us a little bit about where it came from and all the culture around Blinky.
Well, I think it came from my original ideas for the company that I started. I was in bicycles like a lot of people from when they were preteens. And when I started doing like retail bike, I wanted to do customized things of like specialty bikes. And I started by modifying pre-made frames for what people were interested in, because it's the same thing. Like what the companies were doing was good, but it was never exactly the thing that the kind of customers that I was dealing with wanted. So that compelled me to like utilize some of my background in fabrication and just mechanical stuff to make bikes to order. And that led me to like, I'm never going to be able to supply a bike to order unless I can build the frame.
When was that?
That was like the late, that would be the early 80s. I got interested in the late 70s due to like my own limitations, because at 5'4" in the 70s, it was hard to find the kind of bike I wanted that would fit me. And the kind of customers, which were friends of mine, that I was shopping with. So there was the need for bicycles that met touring needs and for small people. But more when I got into like bicycle retail and I was dealing with a wide range of customers, I was looking to like fill a certain type of bicycle. Anyway, going forward is, after I got a little bit of press with Bicycling Magazine and I worked with some subcontractors in England, I could see I was not going to get a bike that like met my idea of what would be quality fabrication. And so I had to like get into it. But I called my bicycle company. I said, well, I'm going to make a bicycle company as opposed to being, let's say, a small frame builder. And so I started with the idea, like, even though it was just me, I gave it the name Sterling because I wanted to eventually have a bicycle company instead of being, whatever, Bruce Gordon.
I don't think anybody wants to be Bruce Gordon.
Well, yeah. So it was called Sterling Cycle Company with the idea that it would be a multi-person company someday. And so pretty much even from my first shop, after I like went into debt and bought a paint booth and a fixture and did some learning with one of the builders from England, and there was no internet, of course, so the whole learning process, and like you said, the tribal thing was completely different. I would always have some kind of helper. And so one helper led to having like more than one helper. And so at different iterations of the company, you know, we had between 5 and 10 people. And so in some of my interviews, I say, well, I've built a lot of bicycles through the years, but I also have built a lot of frame builders. And so as much as I like was doing production bicycles, I was actually creating other bicycle builders.
What do you think led to that? Because there's a big difference between having an employee that works for you for a period of time, and then they move off to maybe a different job or whatever, but they just, their employee mindset versus somebody that's with, like, say, with you, and they become their own character within the cinematic universe type of thing. Like, is there something about you or your method or your location that instills that? I know that, like, I was at Fat City Cycles, and Chris Chance was an interesting character at the time, and then he had an operation that gave the people that worked there a lot of leeway on structuring their lives and their work the way they needed to, and it fostered a huge amount of creativity, where when people left, they had gained skills, but also they had been creative enough where they knew what they wanted to do. And some companies do that very well. Some companies don't do it at all. And, I mean, I would say just reputationally, your company did that quite a bit in terms of turning out people. What was it maybe about that did that?
That's interesting. There's that whole thing of, like, corporate culture. Obviously, we were, like, not corporate at all. And I guess what made it more fertile is that I was more interested in, like, the bikes and the bike processes and, you know, satisfying the customer, but also satisfying the employee. And I could, I don't know, I'll just say I could tolerate more mistakes and more divergent ideas, rather than I have a set product, I only want it to be like this, and you're just going to learn one piece of it until, you know, you satisfy my particular standards. And so I, you know, other places where you were very compartmentalized, here I kind of, like, get people's, like, whatever their inclination, like, if they did better with machining or brazing or that, you know, I tried to encourage and expand their skill level. And so it wasn't necessarily good. It was not necessarily the most cost effective. And so, like, basically it didn't, like, make a lot of profit, because we just spent a lot of time either learning or, you know, fixing mistakes.
Well, looking at your social media in the modern sense, it looks like you have, you know, quite a family and a crew when you're in the building environment there.
Yeah, well, it's been up and down. So, you know, we had bigger, more expansive, like, pre-recession of 2008. And so that was like a big build-up decade based, you know, the buy local and, you know, buy artisan was, like, really coming into fashion, we'll say, you know, got popular. And I guess people were doing, I don't know, I guess maybe it was more easy for people to, like, look at different jobs or different kinds of vocation situations. And like you said, I tried to be as, like, flexible for, like, well, I can only work this much time, or I want to do this, but I still keep this other job. And obviously that would work for us too, because in most instances we never had, like, really large budgets and big salary positions, but people got to learn, and so that was, like, the trade-off.
Could you name, say, a bunch of people or entities that kind of were birthed out of your world, maybe people that went on to become known frame builders or bicycle people, or even started their own companies that went somewhere, or it could have something totally unrelated to, like, bicycling now, but you've known a lot of people, and a lot of people that may have been very driven, passionate, and creative. Can you name some of those people or things that happened that kind of stoke you out to think about?
Well, I guess it's going both ways. I've had times where people came from other companies. You know, basically there would always be a certain amount of, like, bike shop oriented people that have worked in bicycle retail that were either burnt out or looking to do more. and would come, and that would be maybe more short-lived. They'd either find out frame building wasn't for them, but it would be helpful for us, or they did part and they learned something, and they even built some of their own bikes. So those people, that was more temporary. Someone like, we had somebody come from Burley, and he had been at Burley and Co-Motion, and like, you know, did a lot of good work for us, but then afterward pretty much went on to just going into the CAD world. You know, so basically people would go with some part of what they learn. I've had a lot of artists, and so like they're not really in the bicycle fabrication world anymore, but they're like more developed in their particular like sculpture or other arts. Simon obviously is probably a well-known person, Simon Firth, who was probably one of the longest employees, and he went on to found Hanford Cycles, but then became much more involved in his retail operation, and so I don't think he's really building. Bob Kamzelski went on to found Bantam Bicycles, or Bantam Cycles, I forget, in Portland. So he, you know, really took it on. He was like, I'll call him the West Philly apartment builder. And so we've had a few of those where they build in their living room. And then basically we have a whole shop with machines and things. So it's a real an environment for someone who's already like gone down the exploring road and come to us. Then they can usually really blossom with the machinery. And so he went on, and you know, he's, I would say, a very accomplished builder. We had a gentleman on the other side in the like marketing who actually helped founded this show and didn't really know much about bikes, but he was like a marketing kind of personality. And so he went on to work at Trek Bicycle and worked with their Bontrager wheel division and then their retail division. I have another person who like worked in the company and now working for Fuji, you know, in sales.
How does that make you feel when you, I mean, not a lot of people that aren't in formal teaching get to watch people blossom out into their full selves in a way. And in a way, you have a little pirate ship going where people get cast off to do their thing. I mean, I was a product when I was younger of Maximus Skate Park and Kenny Deutsch. This is a Boston thing. And that was a huge influence on a lot of people. Hmm. And we all went on to do things, but that clubhouse, that pirate ship that we were on was crucial in our development, and you may be that with a lot of people. And how does that kind of make you feel, just kind of being able to look out and seeing at people's lives you affected? Because in a way, that's one of the greatest things we can do as people. All we have is time, and our only way of changing the world is by affecting other people.
Yeah, I mean, that's a similar thought pattern or whatever that I've like thought about. It's like, you know, each bike you put out, so then you have people out in the world riding your bike that you've interacted with and like come back and talk about their bike, but also to have people out there, oh well, that was the best job I ever had, or I learned how to TIG weld and now I do this, or I painted and now I design and do that. So I guess other than like you said, being like a really formal teacher where you're like affecting, you know, you're turning out degree doctors or something. So, you know, making that influence in the world and also trying to make some influence in the world of how business is conducted and what people can do rather than just be plugged into the corporate world.
So you mentioned the corporate world a few times, and maybe you have a lot of things that are in opposition to that. What is, from a company standpoint, what are you trying to do as a company that is in contrast to this corporate world thing? What is the problem that you're trying to solve?
Well, I don't know if it's a problem. It's just, I guess one is the 9-to-5, you know, the highly structured, highly compartmentalized, where you only see one small piece of some bigger puzzle or bigger product, that people have more control over the time, the product, and their development. And so, you know, being trying to able to foster that. Obviously, we always have the limitation of we don't have a big budget. So it is like even fostering some entrepreneurship within the, you know, the confines of like being employed by someone else. But you know, some responsibility that each person's like, well, if we could bring in more money, we could do more of this or more of that. And so it just gets people just more engagement into what they're doing. I guess when I grew up, I just saw a lot of people like working the same thing and always trying to figure out something else other than their job that would be like keep their interest. You know, I'm going to go golf when I can. So instead of like trying to figure out what to do when you have free time, make the time that you're working like what's the real engagement. Whether that's really like turned a corner or not, you know, there's so much economic turmoil, and the bike business and the amount of, I guess, you know, spending, the amount of money that's in the industry, as you can see, compared to other things, is so small that maybe it's not that much impact. But the way the world's going, one of the things is like everything about self-propelled transport is becoming more essential. People like taking more control and not depending on other outside structures or big organizations to sort of like make their living. Those trends, and people wanting to do things with their own hands. I guess that's the other thing. It's like being involved in the creation of products or things in their own head. So usually, you know, there's more tools, more technology, which has allowed some decentralization and like more small scale things to flourish.
So to step back from people, maybe we could talk about things now. In terms of, so you're making a bicycle and you have to be a craftsman. What is your favorite part of the craft of building a bicycle? What do you enjoy? What gives you a lot of satisfaction within the actual hands-on making of the bike?
Well, I think the very best is like the flowing of two materials together. So I'm quite drawn and usually much more like connected when I'm doing brazing, welding, and even painting, because that's where like this transformation of like separate entities into something, you know, whether it's like a new shiny colored surface that connects these different pieces, or the actual connecting together of just loose pieces of tubing to become something that. But also it's the melting, you know, when that one thing changes state and flows to the other, that's like the best. Probably close to that, because I have like, I do like the numbers. I like the hard thing of like tolerances and shapes interacting. So like actually cutting. I don't know anything about 3D printing, and I'd like to get some more into casting, because I find casting and forging, which of course is not within my power, but you know, casting would be interesting to me. So the connecting of advanced manufacturing to some more standard processes, like kind of that would interest me, making 3D models. and turning them into casts. I mean, doing a water jet and laser jet of like shapes that you can control on a computer and then actually get in your hand. I like the final product more than just like drawing on a screen.
We all have to solve problems when we build bikes, whether they're with tooling or with the bike itself or with our attitude or something like that. But maybe there's a, excuse me, what is a problem that you solved that you're extremely proud of and you thought was a real achievement for you to have solved that problem? And then what's the most recent problem you may have solved in the building of the bike?
Well, excellent questions. And I should be able to answer that quickly. But usually on the spot, I'm pretty terrible because my memory is not as good. Because obviously I've solved a lot of problems. A lot of times it's got to do with like holding a tube or a piece in some way that's like quick, easy, and that that doesn't require, let's say, a second person to actually do it for me while I'm that. So simple fixturing, you know, of a pump peg or, you know, a boss or something like that, I find pretty satisfying, especially if I can like pull it out of a drawer and not like go through like a lot of permutations to get to it. On the other hand, I like the fact that I've got all these 24 millimeter round fork blades that weren't very long. Hi.
We have a guest. Who are you?
REI.
REI, what are you doing here?
Walking around showing my aunt all the booths.
Is that fun? Are you the expert?
Sort of.
Nice. He's got a Junkyard Cat shirt on. Way to go.
Oh yeah.
Nice. We're gonna go on and complete. We're recording. See? It's a recorder.
I wanna hear the video.
You wanna hear it?
Yeah.
Alright, well we gotta finish first. Alright.
And I'm out.
There we go. Good job. Okay.
So this is more of like a combination of it's somewhat of an economic thing, because if you have a whole bunch of materials that don't seem to have a use, it's like, oh, well, that's like good stuff that needs to like figure out a good home, rather than like, well, that's kind of obsolete or not useful. To be able to take that and like turn it into something that's like useful now, satisfy something inside me. I guess I'm also like, I'm really bad at throwing anything away.
I know that feeling.
So if I can like repurpose, you know, either like an old jig or an old tube or anything I picked up from before that I said, oh, that's useful. You know, it's a threaded rod or an already half-shaped thing that I can add a hole. So that's really important. But like particular these like fork blades that like now I took the time and made like 24 millimeter bending die so that I can like change the shape and add, you know, a chainstay bend. And so now these fork blades that were like bigger than most people use and like in thicker wall to get something like particularly like on a tandem and get the tire clearance and do a combination of bending, indenting, and tapering. And like now have a piece, because with old dropouts, it was never even long enough. The part wasn't long enough, but now with the disc brakes, the part that would seem almost obsolete now is like come into its own.
It's funny when things that we couldn't do before are suddenly easier to do or the desired thing, and we can just solve a problem that before we just wouldn't be able to.
Yeah. I've gotten lucky in that I was either in the right place at the right time, but I was able to get a lot of the tooling from Cerata Cycles when they closed. And the main thing and it hasn't been that big of a commercial thing, but having that swager with the dyes that they had has allowed me to do some things that I couldn't do, besides the fact, like, fixing old Colorado frames where the tube doesn't exist. I think that was a kind of interesting, I'll say, problem. I don't have the CNC that I once had became, like, non-operational. And I had a job where I needed to get that oval shape, and so I had no way to, CNC an ellipse. And so by making a series of depth, basically, a model of the oval, and using, I think it was a 3/4 ball end mill at different depths and positions on it, XYZ manual machine, was to be able to create an oval that changed from, like, a tight radius to a large radius, and make a wooden, a form that I could then ovalize, from the parent 1¼ inches and get an oval after swaging the 1⅜ inch tube down to 1¼ inches and making this totally new shape out of something that, was just like a basic round tube. Whatever, using some combination. I guess I'm not that deep into just like advanced manufacturing, like model to 3D printing, but this thing of like, using some CAD and then the manual machine. So it's like there is skill. It was a combination of skill and the computer program to create a thing that, like, it was in between a hand-built and, a machine-made thing.
Well, certainly I believe in using CAD as much as possible to solve problems and figure things out. And, in fact, the method you were just describing, using the ball mill at various depths and positions, I've used a number of times. And when you're talking about that, I'm thinking about, I work in physics research, and I had to machine a lens out of Teflon for a microwave lens. It was a microwave lens out of Teflon. And on the manual machine, I went on the CAD, figured out the lens profile, and then figured out a whole bunch of angled cuts I could make on the lathe to approximate the lens shape, and then hand work it into a smooth profile. And effectively, I mean, granted, it would have been pretty Galilean as an actual lens, but it worked well enough for microwave experimentation. And it was just that kind of thing. Use the CAD, get some good numbers, and then use your skill on the manual machine to make something that would otherwise be impossible to just machine,
Right. Yeah, I love that. Because it's like, there's that thing of, a certain hand, I haven't really achieved it in the level I'd like to, but, beside this whole thing of company building bikes, which is my product, I've done some other product, building people that can, like, help build the company or build the product or the methods of the product or connecting with customers, is how to, like, combine what's out there in technologies, combined with, like, trained hands that, like, it's just beyond one or the other. Because I always felt, that's why when I'm going back to the very beginning, if I'm just one person, I'm, like, limited to, like, how many knives I can produce or how many of this. So I wanted to, like, amplify myself. But at the same time, I wanted to be able to bring this, like, a certain personality and a certain artistic vision into what I do, so it doesn't become like just cookie cutter bikes. So that's basically been one of my personal challenges. And so the thing is, it requires a certain amount of capital goods, which obviously requires capital, and also requires a certain amount of, like, able-bodied and, like, interested people, because it involves that creative pirate ship thing where it's like, I get more done and I can, like, jujitsu my way into, like, bigger problems and more bigger solutions. So as much as I like sort of like working at 2 a.m. and having nobody saying anything, which, you know, is you need a certain amount of that time, hey, there's nothing like being able to work with someone who sees it just a little bit different or has another skill level that I don't. And so, yeah, I like, you know, we get that kind of thing going. And so I'm looking to do that again before I say, well, I'm going to retire into a garage, or I have a big enough company where somebody can run it for me. So I'm still in the I still have the tension of I'm like, to me, I'm still a startup.
So I can wrap this up because I know we both have stuff to do.
Yeah.
Last question.
And hopefully you're a great editor.
I won't be editing at all. I don't have the time. I'm just going to post it.
Okay.
It's just going to, it's fine. You're doing great. Last question. Of all your bikes, and I think you probably have a ton of bikes, which is the one that you want to get rid of and haven't been able to, probably because you just don't let it go, and which is the bike that you'll never get rid of?
Huh. So bikes I own.
Yeah, your bikes. I'm sure you have a garage full of 40 bikes.
Well, I have a ceiling of a lot of bikes. I don't have much personal attachment to them. Because, you know, I've accumulated, I've either, like, built it and it didn't do something, or it's just something else I acquired from the trash or a trade-in or something like that. I have this really great Phrygis ladies frame. I don't know, I have this thing of, like, whatever, like, 50s, 60s, I'll just call them pedestrian Italian bikes, you know, utility bikes. And this, and they have a certain kind of like elegance in their like simple, you know, they weren't to be pretentious, and they were like to get people around, but they didn't just...
Bikes that people really used and relied on.
Yeah, they really used and relied on, but at the same time, like a lot of things in like older, you know, industrial production is like, they just added a little flair. And so this Phrygis ladies frame, I don't think I would, you know, I haven't really done much with it, but I would never get rid of it. I have a lot of projects of, like, bikes, if I could do this or that to it, you know, they would be done, and, like, it'd be nice to see them, like, go somewhere. I'm not sure if that answers that question, but I have, like, a Jetan tandem that maybe, you know, a little... some parts upgrades and like maybe an internal ladder. I saw once at a flea market, at a swap meet, someone took that similar tandem and added a lateral and like made a pretty good riding tandem out of it. And I was like, oh, that's a good project. Find a home for that.
Okay, that's good. Is there anything you'd want to say if someone was listening to this interview that the whole world would hear, or at least the whole world, according to people that go onto my blog, would want to hear?
I guess the main thing is, I don't know, is just to keep the excitement.
Stay stoked.
Yeah, you got to stay engaged and really, like, interested. Somehow, if it, like, once it falls too far into, like, something that you just, like, churn out, then, you know, then the passion's gone. So, keeping that alive, which obviously is difficult.
I will say I talk often about how to keep the stoke, because without that, everything's really hard.
Yeah. And, of course, keep riding, because you got to, like, ride the bikes to keep getting that, like, feedback on what, like, you know, either for developmental purposes or just the fact of, like, what it really does, which is, like, why the bike really sort of, like, connected with you. Because most people are in this industry somehow got really connected to bikes, as opposed to, like, how will I make money fixing people's teeth?
It's not a rational industry.
No, it's a lot of irrationality, but that's what makes it really fun.
Right. Thank you so much for spending the time.
All right. Thank you.